And I believe Sun Radio Project will be on at 11. You can podcast this show at kboo.fm. And you can, the playlist should be posted sometime later this evening. So keep it tuned here to KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is always looking for ways people can work with us and support us. KBOO has a wish list, and we'd love help getting some of those items donated. Some things on our list include a color printer, digital recorders, a pop-up canopy, dishwashing detergent, brooms and mops, or services like roofing, plumbing, and electrical work. Please contact station co-manager Delphine at del@kboo.org or go to kboo.fm/kboo's wishlist for more information about supporting your favorite community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio will be broadcasting live from the 30th Annual Waterfront Blues Fest, June 30th through July 4th, from noon to 10 p.m. Tune in to hear sets from Big Head Blues Club, Chris Isaac, Corey Henry and the Funk Apostles, The Pimps of Joy Time, Bo Farcaturi, and more. Again, that's a live broadcast from the 30th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival benefit for the Oregon Food Bank. Saturday, June 30th through July 4th, noon to 10 p.m., every day here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Portland. Hello, folks. Welcome to Poetry and Everything. I'm Judith Arcana, your host. Each month we have guests who are Portland poets, nearby poets, faraway poets, pairs of poets, groups of poets, sometimes even folks who are not poets, but everybody's reading and talking about poetry and everything. Each time we open with me reading a bit of my own work, and then the guest and I read work by other poets, and then we take off toward the world of the guest's poetry. So tonight, the poem of my own I'm going to read is called Identification. Today, I renewed my driver's license. Trying to get the jump on that bad camera, the one that makes us all look awful, I took an early shower, waited till my hair was dry, packed an umbrella just in case, took a clip to pull my hair back. I was trying to make up for all the dreadful pictures I'd been carrying my whole life. The first one, age 15, State of Illinois Learner's Permit. I was definitely, my boyfriend told me, a cute girl. I brushed my hair in the women's room, put in the clip, looked in the mirror, saw that it was good. I was good. This time would break the classic chain. No shame. You must already know my strategy failed. The bizarre bad magic of that bad camera, evil twin to the one at the passport office, caught me again. Believe me, I looked into that mirror one full vanity minute before I sat down and looked again, post-flash, when I was handed the unfortunate photo. Both times, silver hair clipped with style, that cute girl, all grown up, was looking good. I saw her in the mirror, but not in the picture. I thought I'd read an amusing, although actually tragic, poem tonight, folks. All right, well, I want to introduce our guest tonight, who is Claudia F. Savage, who is one half of the performance duo Thick in the Throat, Honey. What a great title. And co-runs the forthcoming music poetry label Thrum Recordings. Originally from Queens, New York, Claudia spent equal years in the wilds of North Carolina and Colorado, where she got her MA in Asian Literature and Women's Studies, before landing in Portland. As a poet, she thrives on interdisciplinary collaboration and experiment. Her collaboration, Reductions, about motherhood and ephemerality, with Detroit artist Jacqueline Brickman, will be exhibited November this year, 2017, in Chicago. So if you're in Chicago in November this year, you're going to get to see it. Her poems, essays, and interviews are published in journals. Look, I say, specifically for Drunken Boat Anomaly, for her interviews with Arab American poets in her series, Witness the Hour. Claudia has a new book, a poetry collection, Bruising Continents, just out in May, just a little bit ago. Her work also includes The Last One Eaten, A Maligned Vegetable's History, and, with three other poets, The Hour of Anjali. She's been given awards by Gentel, UCross, the Atlantic Center for the Arts, and Oregon's RAC. She lives with her husband and daughter here in Portland. If you want to visit her online, you can. ClaudiaFSavage.com. Welcome, Claudia.
Thanks so much, Judah. It's lovely to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you here. So now Claudia and I will read poems that are not by her and not by me, poems that we've chosen for the part that's other people's work, to bring other poet voices into the studio with us. So what have you got?
I have a poem. This was actually, can I just say how hard this was for me to
say
pick
whatever
just one?
You
it
want.
Was so hard for me to pick one poet.
Oh,
I,
of course.
I just sort yes. of kind of went a little crazy, sort of going, well, should I pick someone I've always loved? Should I pick a new person? So I just finally decided to pick someone that I've been reading more recently, mostly because I'm working on my second book, and that book is about jazz improvisation, among other things. And it has a lot of Alice Coltrane in it, who I adore. And she was a pianist and harpist, for people who don't know, and was married to John Coltrane. She is fabulous. This particular poem is by Ruth Ellen Kocher, who teaches in Colorado, strangely enough. But I love her work, and it's about Alice Coltrane, so that's what I'm going to read.
Okay.
It's called Alice Coltrane and Discovers the World, G-God is Beborn. Brimmed sea light and green harp, you know the squid spun sea, phosphorescent chum, her fingers from which the sea, from which blue tortoise spin and drive, to swim, to swim, to swim, and the creatures all get it, dig. Swim, swim, shore to swim, fur to shore, warm fanged winter's beast, and prey dawn and light plant and seed. Man, of course, beast, comes from a harp. His wings damp, still deep in the rib, harp. His first hunger, first hear hunger's pang, harp, harp.
Very, very cool. Not surprisingly, considering subject and source. Yes.
Do love it.
Yeah. Okay, the one I brought tonight, I like it when it's, of course, happenstance, because we never know, the guest and I, what each, you know, the other is going to mm-hmm. choose, is quite different. And I like that, although it would be pretty amazing in a good way if we showed up with maybe the same poet or the same poem. That's not happened yet. We shall see. Okay, this one is by a guy named Michael Blumenthal, and it's called Here You Are. It's such a relief to see the woman you love walk out the door some nights, for it's 10 o'clock and you need your 8 hours of sleep, and one glass of wine has been more than enough, and as for lust, well, you can live without it most days, and you are glad, too, the Ukrainian masseuse you see every Wednesday is not in love with you and has no plans to be, for it is the pain in your back you need relief from most, not that ambiguous itch, and the wild successes of your peers no longer bother you, nor do your unresolved religious cravings or the general injustice of the world. No, there is very little, in fact, that bothers you these days. When you turn first to the obituaries, second to the stock market, then, after a long pause, to the book review. You are becoming a good citizen. You do your morning exercises, count your accumulated small blessings. Thank the Lord that there's a trolley just outside your door your girlfriend can take back home to her own bed. And here you are. It is morning. You are alone. Every little heartbeat is yours to cherish. The future is on fire with nothing but its own kindling, and whatever is burning in its flames, it isn't you. And now you will take a shower, and this is it.
That's fabulous.
Yes, I thought so too. And here's the thing, you know, I'm interested always in the immediate context. You write a poem, you read a poem, and then you look at it later, mm-hmm. and the whole world has changed since you first found it or wrote it. And so one of the things I thought about when I was choosing this is, well, there's nothing overtly political here. It's interesting to see that this guy, he even says he's not concerned with the world. And I'm thinking, can anyone be like this now? I think not. Not in this country, anyway. Not at this moment. But I could be wrong. Who knows?
It is interesting, though, that him looking at the stock market actually places him firmly in the West. I mean, for sure.
I'll say, yeah. And also, I mean, it's a class identification.
Totally.
Also, you can assume, or at least I do, that he's reading the New York Times.
Right.
So it's, it is and it isn't. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Okay. Before we leap into the next section, saying hello to folks who may have just tuned in, this is KBOO Portland Community Radio, and the guest tonight on Poetry and Everything is Claudia F. Savage, and Claudia is just about, you got here just in time, folks, even if you didn't check in at the beginning, because Claudia is now about to give us a reading. So please,
thanks,
read
Judith.
To us.
I'm going to read from my book that just came out in May. And I do want to sort of caveat this, what I'm going to read, by saying that this book is about sort of the end of a marriage and the beginning of a love affair, but it's not quite that clean, for sure, as most things of that nature are not. In that my marriage was ending while I was falling in love with someone else, but I definitely still had longing for the person that I was leaving, who I'd spent 13 years with. And so the book doesn't have titles to the pieces, partially because I wanted to create kind of a mood that mirrored how I felt about having both these things happen simultaneously. And that emotional state, I wanted people to sort of get into that emotional state of the only thing that you can see that differentiates it is sort of the him becomes a you, because I always think of the you as being this beloved thing. So that's the thing that sort of changed throughout the piece. So I'm going to read kind of a selection, so you go on a little bit of a journey with me to get a feel for the book and how it evolves, rather than telling you titles. I'm just going to pick out some pieces, and we're just going to go on a little trip together.
All right. We're ready.
Once we were river water. Our murmurings soothed other animals, cooled their fevered bodies. They sipped at our banks, then stayed. We flowed over rocks as liquid light. When he first sprouted bone, I reasoned how small and hollow, bird-like and fit for flying. I refused to worry. I sucked at sun. Wild mint made love on my borders. I flowed. Grasses, dirt, even mountains, bottomless me, never sufficiently lush. Around each bend, my current quickened the length of the moon. He began to linger. I remember the sound of roots, the low whine of burrow, my deep harmony, trumpeting, pushing, trumpeting. And when the stars gathered seductive, light cold, we were only connected by dreaming. Perhaps this is how every bend in a too wide river is made. One stream seeking forest, the other longing for the quickest path to sea. My dress flutters like desert poppies not yet picked by autumn wind. Their petals spread to the sun like a new mouth. His mouth. It always starts at his mouth. On the porch, I watch the wind push each thought through his hair, craving altitude. Here, in the mountains, even shadows are blown to rags, so I should cling to him as it howls. The pulse of our years is in his neck. The smell of our sheets left too long on the line. The smell of our bolted garden. Early fall, he'll miss the rain, that younger dewy us opening. I'll claim to miss nothing. The sun and I understand the pleasure of what is brief. We bruise the surface of continents, then turn away. Only granite could bookend my star-flung shadow. That night, I walked the steepest face by moon. The wind ripped at my eyes, so I shut them to claim old names. Tiresias, Inanna, consonants off the pebbles of my teeth. Almost there, a turquoise butterfly's wing beneath my foot, locked in snow. Not now, I thought, but picked it anyway. In the dark universe of my left palm it thawed. With heat it trembled. I'll call you beauty. The wind wouldn't get everything. I would be the sea, the color of new eyes. Bear down without froth, without fury, I would stop. So sick of how we grow thirstier. Oh, to be a winter tree when the sap slows. Bittersweet shiver, unquiet this life. I'll blame it on the jungle. The bees knew, their wings heavy through the soupy air, that constant sound of armadillos snuffling the dead leaves, long tongues poking for treasure. I hated heat until that month. I'll blame it on the lizard that got lost in my room and pulsed its giant red throat when I cupped it in my hand. Everything was a heartbeat. I'll blame it on the night you asked me to walk the bamboo bridges above the canopy, dared me to stare at 3-foot spiderwebs in lamplight. That month, nothing scared me. Not the giant spiders full of fur, not the alligators swimming beside our rooms, not the fire ants that ravaged my toes. I was the flame, the webs harbingers of moonlight, intricate stars, intricate pattern of my heart. You found me and wove music through my hair. 6 days the Everglades burned. We might have made that persimmon moon, fat, round joy, into the lantern-lit ocean, sparked once more, thick in the throat, honey. You ask me to take off my shirt, your eyes smooth lakes to paddle through. Even before you reach for me, I know I will refuse you nothing. In the still gray light, you trace my hemispheres. I'm loose sugar, sweet scattered under your fingers' oscillation. Give me back. Give me back to the dawn, my long, cool drink of water, my deep pool where the sharks hunt, crushed indigo. How will I keep you burning when I lack weather vane, and there is no guarantee of lightning, no collision of heat? I ask you to look deeper at the singed trees along my spine, to not be distracted by my shoulder's healthy pine, to let your lips maroon when I pull my hair up. Let slip the tender skin that has never felt the sun. Watch as you cross a room. You cross a room to tongue that bright spot. Hungry match. Thirsty wood. And finally, I'm just going to read this last piece of the book that is
my favorite part.
That's called Folklore. I will take the rain into my mouth as if it were your skin. Complicit, I can be a pleasure bird, seeking the damp seed, the well-oiled wing in the corner of what explodes quickly. So as not to wake the evening, I will weave mist into my hair as if I bore it. Clouds on blue tuck into dreams of sapphire. Sunsets cough red, orange scream, stars alerted to their queen. When I wade into the Willamette, the barren trees my bridesmaids, the fog my coat, the fields hush the highways for roses to unfurl, sodden scent, blighted leaf, a second time, pale weeping figs, colored as grass, protect their flower. Rosemary thickens, wild persimmons wash the muted heavens. We sleep past the lit wood and poured tea. A sigh against my shoulder holds that dappled light. Cinnamon in my hair, your neck exposing its honey. My pale finger, startled snow against the sheet, glow hazy breasts below a day-spied moon. When we greet the rain, you seek the soggy roots, the maiden hair and fur stomped through this dark gray lullaby of beaten maple, triumphant spruce. The salmon might make me an optimist returning, hook-nosed and wonder-eyed, giant silver fish, dinosaur fish, braver than us, sacrificing fish returning. A blanket of troubled river hushes the waterfall where they leapt 14,000 years. Still it seeps, weeps, magic water falls and falls as berry leaves, as ivy crowds the corners of my head, and the city floods, and 1,000 beers a night pour, and 1,000 coffees a day pour, and movies sell out, and pork bellies in every breakfast, noodle swirl, ice cream bowl, and bike fenders sing, and scarves squeeze, and the feral ring-tailed cat I covet hard curls my front door. Softly, I will court the sun, confide in the crocus the solution to our malaise. Rain, rain, down the drain, drain. I'll sacrifice your yard chicken. Offer my naked sight to the frightened light. The key to the Pacific Northwest is a wool hat and good jacket. Whiskey helps, coffee helps, sex helps, sometimes. There is deeper quiet somewhere when we escape further west. The churning wind scoops at my brain like butter, and I'm lost to the rocks as foam, as seagull, as crab feast by sandpiper, needing soft meat, sweet, sweet. The sun must agree to end my misery. Wind threatens the bone-pulsed hemlocks with permanent gale. We stop looking for whole sand dollars, bare feet to the icy water. Kelp kite at my toe, giant clams suck the roof for air. If I say yes to you, your city, fate, yes. Will the volcanoes dream their worried dreams? The Columbia remember a time before steel, the blackberry thicket's ardor. When I fly into strange and dark salty grasses, nights on fire, hidden fish glowing at the muscle, will you follow? To a place where you can throw your lungs into that horn, and the herbs sacrifice their young to a god of your making. Sun, after days upon nights upon days of water, I warm your mouth with my mouth. We vibrate the air once more.
All right. One of the really cool things about this book, of course, which you alluded to, you said the poems don't have any titles, but I didn't even think about it that way when I was your reader. I was thinking of the sections, which do have names, and I was thinking of the, what I just have to call the progression, the plot, so to speak, of the book. And was struck by the fact that this is an unusual move on the part of the poet to do this. And so I'm going to open with one question about that, and then I have some questions that are not specific to this book.
Yeah.
So when you were putting this book together, when you were making this book,
yes,
in whatever way you were making this book, were you saying to yourself, I'm going to create these sections, I'm going to not title the poems, you know, stuff like that, or what was going on?
Yeah, that's a great question, Judith. And it's one of these where I've been telling my students how many versions I've had of this book lately and discouraging them. So I need to stop doing that.
No, don't do that.
I think this might be the 38th version of the book. I'm not sure. I lost count at a certain point, mostly because I had a child and things just got kind of wonky around that with having a small child. But I think I did have, so just to explain the making of the book, because it's sort of unusual and strange, I, in 2007, got into, I think, 6 or 7 artist residencies. And at the time, I was cooking for people going through chemo. And so I had this whole bunch of poems, which I've never published, actually, just about that experience of cooking for many of these people who were dying.
Oh, you'll have to do that at some point.
I'm sorry
to say, in this very negative teacherly way, as opposed to positive teacherly way, you have to do that.
Right.
Sorry to interrupt.
No. So the last one, Eaten, that little chapbook about vegetables, came sort of, that was part of that whole collection in terms of just many of my clients didn't want to eat vegetables, this whole thing. So, but I wrote all these pieces. And so I got into all these residencies based on these pieces. And then I went to the Atlantic Center for the Arts and I met my husband, John. And well, my whole world just sort of exploded in a month. And I was like, oh, now I'm not writing these sweet little pieces about my clients. Now I'm writing these bizarre, I wrote these huge pieces, some of which are in this book, about just music and falling in love and all these sorts of things. And so everything just sort of went crazy. And as a result of that, I was doing a lot of backpacking at the time, and I started backpacking and searching out fires and searching out water. I had this idea that the book would be composed of these sections that had elements in them.
Ah, fire and water.
Right, fire and water, yeah. Air. I read this, actually, if you look in the dedication in the book, I was very obsessed with this book on clouds. I've heard this guy's become quite famous. He's in Cambridge in England, and he wrote this crazy book about cloud spotting, and I was sort of obsessed, because when you backpack, you know, you're out there,
you're
and
out there with
you're
the
looking
clouds.
At the clouds, yeah. And you're like, oh, is that a lenticular? Is that a, you know, astrocumulus. So I thought originally I was going to sort of do that with the book. I had all these cloud names, all these river names, and I started sending the book out with these sections like river, and I think I had clouds and something else. And, you know, I got rejection after rejection after rejection. And finally, I sort of thought, no, this is, you know, I started talking with poet friends and I was like, this is a narrative. I need to give into this. I need to give into the fact that this is a story.
Absolutely, and a narrative.
Right. And you know, this, at this point, this, the way the book is constructed now with these different sort of suites or sections feels more symphonic to me. And I think that's a result of being with a musician for so many years, that I see the way he composes and the way he exists in the world. And he tends to, like, especially a jazz musician, the way he riffs off of things. That's why my new book is really fun. Just that sort of riffing off of language and whatever. But I think that was definitely, that's a long-winded answer of how that came to be, because I kept evolving with my relationship. This is the problem with all poets, right? Where it's so hard to write a book because you have poems that you wrote 10 years ago, and then you have a new style, perhaps, of what you're writing now, and you have to constantly marry those, and it feels impossible. So because I have a young child, there was a point, I kept revising over time, and finally I made a deal with my husband. I'm like, I'm not gonna work for 2 weeks, and you're gonna watch the kid, and I'm gonna do it. And so that was, here it is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The final revision, so yeah.
Yeah, and the thing about putting together poems from long ago, poems from 10 minutes ago, yeah. poems from possibly tomorrow, is of great importance and value to my way of thinking, this notion that when you do that, you're making something. They mean, well, it's like what I said about yes. the poem that I read. It's different now.
Right.
It is now in a completely other context, and therefore its meaning and perhaps its value are different. So it's so cool.
It is cool. That's what you hope from art anyway. Is that yes. you hope it, you evolve with it.
Yeah.
Or, yeah, you shift. And
you keep learning.
Yes.
And so you do other stuff.
I find it very strange that people always want to go to, like, rock concerts and hear the same. I mean, it's great to hear the same songs. But there's also an aspect of, like, let the poor guys get up there and improvise. Like, yeah. that's, you know, let them be artists.
Well, also, they may have done something new in the last 15 years and want to tell you about it. Maybe. Just maybe. All right. So, okay, another subject. Collaboration and experiment, mm-hmm. you've told me, and I included in your introduction, are important to you.
Yeah.
Please say some words in any way you care to. What is it that's valuable for you in collaboration? What's it giving you?
And then
we'll go to experiment.
Yeah.
Same thing, actually. It's really the same question.
Right.
What is it about doing that?
I think it's... you know, I have to just caveat this by saying that I was first a musician before I became a poet. And I think when you're in certain art forms, it's just sort of a natural thing. Like you get together and you make music or you get together and you... I mean, with poetry, I think sometimes we tend to be very in our little room and in our brain. Not always. I hang out with a lot of weird performance people, but but I do think that it's so for me personally. I desperately am always wanting to get out of my box in my head, and so when I collaborate with people, and again, I took baby steps with this for years. Like I said, I did stuff with musicians, but when I met my husband and I met a bunch of these other artists, I was like, oh right, like we can just get together and make weird art, and I can be influenced by what I see you making. My mother was a painter, and so I think I always noticed her doing this sort of thing. But for me, I think I was quite covetous when I was years ago of my work, and I was like, "You can't. What do you mean you're going to take it and do something with it?" And now I'm very much the opposite, where I'm like, "Yes, take my voice, sample it, do weird. I don't care because." It's like translation, like you're making something new, and then when it comes back to me, I can make something else. So it's this sort of constantly evolving thing that right. feels fabulous. And it all depends on the personality of who you're doing that with. That's the thing.
No doubt.
No doubt. And is it working well or is it not? The label that you mentioned that my husband and I are starting, Thrum Recordings, we're pairing poets with musicians, and we're very deliberate in these pairings, but we have no idea what is going to happen
of
when
course.
They collaborate.
There's no way you could.
Right. But we have this notion of, like, we're thinking about it more in terms of, will these people enjoy each other as people? And if they do, then perhaps mm-hmm. they'll mm-hmm. be open to hearing the other person go, I really hate that stanza, or I really enjoy that lick. Can you do that, you know, three more times? That kind mm-hmm. of thing. So I think that's it. It's just Yeah, and working with my husband especially, I mean, it's how we've survived having a child. I mean, it's just been so hard. I mean, I love my kid dearly. Oh, I'm so sorry if my child is going to listen to this, but she's four, and it's very tough. And to not get into that space where we're only talking about, you know, sleep issues or has she had enough to eat today or whatever it is, we keep this book around the house where he'll compose something and then I'll, like, write to it, or we'll go back and forth. And it's play. It allows mm-hmm. me to not have so much, you know, when you write a book, you're like, oh, I'm holding onto it so tight. But mm-hmm. collaboration is play. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good.
Okay. And would you include the concept of experimentation within collaboration, or is it a separate thing? Or, I mean, obviously it could go either way.
Yeah, it can go either way. That's a good question. I like that you make that distinction, though, Judith, because... I think experimentation for me, it happens both those places. It often happens if you perform the things that you're collaborating on, though. That's where things get really strange, mm-hmm. I find.
Well, because the audience is now part of what's happening.
Yes, yes.
You're not alone. You're not just with the partner you were working with. Now right. There's these other people, and they're part of it.
Yes, and yeah. Their emotional state and, like, what's happening. And
the vibe in the room.
Right. And speaking yeah. of that, you mentioned the thing that I'm doing with the Detroit artist. Well, the gallery that we got accepted to in Chicago, we just saw it, and it's very small. Mm-hmm. And we did a little Skype session, and we had a moment where what we're doing is quite large.
Oh.
And I mean, she's a sculptor. It's huge. It's supposed to go up, like, on tall ceilings. And anyway, I don't understand why. I mean, they liked our work, but it is one of those things where the first thing she said to me was, well, perhaps we're going to do a smaller version of our thing too. And I was like, oh, I didn't think, I mean, to me, I was like, this, the whole thing has gone sideways, but yeah, that's a good, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Versions.
Versions.
It's a useful concept. Right. Okay. All right. You also write prose.
Mm-hmm.
So if you care to, say a few words about how you come to, let's say there's a particular issue, theme, concern, topic, story, whatever, and you're thinking, I want to write about that. And do I want to write prose, or do I want to be lyrical? Does that happen? Do you think about it that way? I mean, if not, we can just go on to the next question. But
that's interesting.
It's something that interests me, so I ask.
Yeah, so do I think, when I'm writing the prose, do I think, how can I make this more poetic, or?
No, when you, even before you first hit the keyboard or put the pen in your hand or whatever,
mm-hmm.
you think, okay, I've got this XYZ. Is it, do I want to make prose with this XYZ? Or do I want to be lyrical with XYZ? Do I want music behind my brain while I, you know?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting you ask that question, because I have been struggling with this one project that, because I usually work on multiple books at one time, so I have kind of three going right now, and I'm going to see which makes the front right. of the race.
One will push the others.
One will push
that's the way it works for me.
Right.
Out, you guys, and out, I'm in. That's what they do.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And yeah, I think David Mitchell said there's, like, all these little horses he sees that are running. Anyway, it's just funny. But so often I'll work stuff in a variety of forms. I think that's it. I don't necessarily think it has to be for this. It's often they're happening simultaneously. So if I'm writing stuff about my mother in prose form, she'll pop into whatever poetry I'm working on.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of unavoidable where that's mm-hmm. concerned. And also the piece I'm writing right now about jazz improvisation. Yeah, my husband is started composing for it, for a group he's got, and he's so funny because he'll always say, "Is it okay that I'm doing this?" I'm like, "Yeah, we don't know what's gonna happen." He's like, "Are you sure? Because this could just be yours." I was like, "No, it's fine. You know, like, we don't know. It could be really fun to perform it as well as have it."
Also,
in the book.
If there is something, not just for you, but for anyone who's anyone who's making art, but certainly word art, you will know if there is something that has to be hands off, just for me. I'm doing it in this little dark room alone. You'll know that, and then you'll be able to say, "You're right. You know what, honey? We're not going to do it that
right.
way.
We're not doing
one.
This together.
Yes,
right.
Exactly.
Right. Right.
Yeah. You'll know." So. Okay, another, a different kind of question. Do you memorize your work?
Yes.
You do?
A lot.
A lot. Okay, and what is that like for you? Is that for performance? Is it part of your learning the piece? You know,
those things. I do it, I was doing it primarily for performance, but I do have to do kind of a little shout out to this woman that I met at the Atlantic Center where I met John. Her name is Tondiwe Shipra. And she's the most anti-social media person I've ever met, which is probably why she's got hundreds of poems in her head. She lives in Nashville. She's amazing. And watching her, when I met her, watching her not only perform her own work, but how she has so many poems in her head that she can weave in other people's work as she's performing her own.
Mm.
Like, it inspires her. Like, she's to that level where she's just got
that's impressive.
A lot. Yeah, it's very impressive. She's like, "Did you hear how I quoted so-and-so?" And I was like, "Wow, yeah." But I think embodying the work has definitely, yeah, I love to do that. It helps me revise. It helps me go through and hear the rhythm. I encourage my students a lot to record themselves, but I think hearing that in your head when you have stuff memorized. Do you memorize stuff, Judith?
I hardly ever memorize. And this is probably why I've begun asking the guests on the show about this. I think that I'm becoming interested in it, but I'm not sure. So I'm hearing all these people talk about it, and
it's
now
so
you're the one who's talking about it.
It's really good. I think it's actually, it's one of these things that it allows us to, I mean, from my perspective anyway, maybe because I used to memorize a lot of music too when I was younger. This is, you know, it feels like a similar technique. Like I never was in theater or anything like that, like a lot of poets, you know, but memorizing like huge amounts of music has a similar quality to you get to this level where it's just like it's in you and there you are and you always have access to it. Yeah, I actually judged the Franklin Poetry Slam. A friend of mine teaches there. She asked me, and the first thing, I was having dinner with the kids before it started, and they all go, "Well, what you got?" I was like, "I got this." And so it is pretty funny to sort of say, "Well, this is like, this is the oral tradition of poetry. Like, we should be doing this, right?"
It is true that when I am performing something I have performed many times, I feel it in exactly the way you're talking about. It's in me. And one of the things that I like about that, which is perhaps why I've all of a sudden begun to think, well, maybe I'll, you know, is one of the things I like about that is that I can be in eye contact and that vibe that I was talking about before in the room with my audience instead of having to look at the page or look at the page very often. So that part is very appealing, no question.
It's very liberating. And you read beautifully. So it just add, it would add you're welcome. It would add like another, I mean, just it kind of adds this other thing where you find yourself, I have to slow down because I have to remember the next line. You know, you read much more slowly, I find, when you perform than you do.
Well, so. Glad I asked. Okay. Now, this is, I alluded to this at the beginning of the show, but now I really would like you to say a few words, as we say, about this. The notion of writing poetry, or making any art for that matter, for what might be called political purposes, political thought and action. Obviously, there's more than one purpose every time you make something, but you know what I'm saying
here.
And it's a big it's a big concern in all arts communities. Yes. So tell us what you think about that.
Well, I'm glad you asked me that question because I... when I got this manuscript accepted, I had a moment where I thought, oh, the work I'm making now is so political, because a lot of what I'm talking about with the jazz improvisation, the artists that I'm featuring are people, many of whom are European, and they definitely have made their work as a response to fascism. And so I have a lot of that sort of those ideas. I have pieces of their interviews in the manuscript, and I'm also talking about Syria and those sorts of things, because I've, as you mentioned, I do these interviews of these Arab American poets, and we've been talking a lot about Syria and sort of the downplay of what's happening with those people in our country, and you know, as a result of terrorism and things of that nature. So it's interesting because I think, you know, this book, I sort of thought, oh, this book, it's just about love, like who's going to want to read it? Nobody cares. Like, all my friends are writing these things about, like, you know, like queer rights and, like, you know, Venezuela and, like, things that are incredibly important and of the moment. So I think, I don't think as an artist you can ever escape those issues. It's more like psychically. One of the poets I interviewed, this poet, Kaveh Akbar, he's an Iranian American, and, he and I talked a lot about sort of the psychic damage of like allowing yourself to absorb loads of things that are going on politically. Like, how can you make art when you're so overwhelmed? Yet, I say that. However, you have to respond to what's going on in the world. That's your role as an artist. So in terms of politics, I think for me, what I've been sort of focusing on is like doing these interviews with these Arab Americans, which I think is really important, especially as things get weirder and weirder with our administration. Just sort of saying, like, there are people that like my grandmother was put in the back of the classroom too. Like I definitely have this feeling of wanting to honor people who are in this country and those sorts of things. But on the other hand, I don't necessarily feel like every single poem I write has to be engaging that. Was that kind of your question?
No, absolutely.
And how do you feel about, I want to know how you feel about that, Judith. Since you asked me the question, I just want to know how every poet is dealing with this. You know, some people are doing so many political things right now. But.
Well, I've thought some of the stuff that you're thinking, of course.
Mm-hmm.
My concern is, first of all, I agree that I have no interest in avoiding it.
Yes.
I have no interest in attempting to keep poetry or any art pure, as if such a thing could even happen.
We exist in the world,
And to ignore or avoid overtly political concerns is of no interest to me. And in fact, I think it's a bad idea.
Yes. Yes.
So that's one part. And also, I think a lot about what that what constellation of responsibilities. See, I wasn't prepared to be answering questions.
Oh, yay!
Here.
I'm so happy.
So now you put me in the. So it's like we're not even on the same microphone here. Okay. So I think a lot about not just the responsibility to do that, which we're that you talked about so well, and that now I'm blathering about, but also the responsibility to make good art,
yes,
as opposed to becoming some kind of screaming poster, some kind of tract that people hand out on the street, I want, no matter what my topic is, no matter what my theme, my subject, whether I'm writing prose or poetry, I want it to be really good art.
Right, and that requires contemplation to some level, and to not do, I have to make a confession. I'm making a confession on the air.
Oh, okay.
So my students are obsessed by the journal Rattle, which I'm not, it's not one of my journals I really read regularly, but they do, they do nice work. And so they're obsessed, and they're always sending into the, whatever it is, like the Friday, they do a Friday response
thing to the newspapers or whatever.
So I thought, okay, they're doing this all the time. I'm going to do it. So I did it, I think, 2 weeks in a row, and it was mostly in response to when the Jewish cemeteries were being desecrated.
Mm.
And I responded to that mostly because I was going to New York at one point during when that was happening to do my grandmother's unveiling of her tombstone at a Jewish cemetery in New Jersey. Okay. So there I am doing that, and I was like, oh, I can engage this. I'm going to engage it. It was very weird for me to write a poem that fast in 4 days and then say, here it is, it's done, eek. But I think, there was purpose to that in that I did feel a sense of, like, I also felt very, like, attached to it. And I was just so disappointed when they didn't pick me. But I was like, how dare they? I worked so hard on this. but I think that's it, is that I felt the urge to engage those things. And we live in a time of like such time, like social media, such timeliness that if you're not in there in a second, you're not relevant. But I don't believe that, because I think when artists are thinking deeply about stuff, like you said, when it's not just a tract and you're just not on your pulpit, when you're thinking deeply, those things are applicable. I'm still writing about what's happening with the refugees in Syria and the conditions they're living under, in places like where my grandmother's from, the Baikal Valley in Lebanon. Like, it was all Christian, like, when she was there. And this and the Muslim community drove the Christians out. And now the Muslim community is being accepted back in as refugees into that area. This is what I mean, this is where, how can we not engage this as poets? Of course we do. But
of course we do. And we have, I mean, clearly you and I agree about this part as well, that, well, we agree about both aspects, this thing about we're not going to write bad work because we want to get the message across.
Quick.
We're not doing bumper stickers here. Well, wait, if we were doing bumper stickers, then we would be doing really good bumper stickers, But generally speaking, that's not the goal. The goal is we want to make, even when it's the kind of beauty that tears the heart right out of your body, we want that beauty.
Yeah.
We want that.
Right.
That's why we're doing this instead of doing the bumper sticker or Hallmark cards or whatever. So,
tweeting incessantly. which I got off Twitter. I couldn't take it with our current president. No, no, thank you.
Okay. All right.
Twitter for me.
Let's see. Looking, we have some time, not a whole lot. So I have at least one or two more questions. Think about what poets or poems that have been particularly useful and important to you. Maybe different ones at different times in your life, like when you were mostly making music and hadn't even really thought of yourself as a poet yet, but still maybe there was a poem that was important, or, I mean, I'm just speculating. But, and then since actually taking it on and now publishing a full collection and so on, what comes to mind, a particular writer or a particular piece or a particular book that has mattered in some way or another?
Wow. This is the kind of question I should have prepared for, Judith, but I'm going to do it. Okay, I can do it.
There are too many. It's like when
many.
Choosing. Yeah.
I want to approach it. For many years, I remember in graduate school, I read the poetry of Lee Young Lee, and he was a touchstone for me. I think partially because I tend to gravitate towards people who are seekers, whether it's Lee Young Lee or Paul Celan. I was just thinking about, he's another one that is just, or G.C. Waldrop is a beautiful poet. They're all kind of seeking, questioning God in the face of misery in some way. And that's it for me, I think. Like at my heart, I adore that sort of work. And that being said, I think lately I've also been really fascinated by people who engage those deep questions, but engage them in a way where the language is so musical. Like one of the men who, the other poem I was going to read that I switched at the last minute, was by a poet named Dan Beachy Quick, who he wrote a blurb for my book, which was like really big for me because I love his work. But I think part of it is, yeah, he's sort of asking these really deep questions. And yeah, like similar to C.D. Wright is another one. These people who, they're asking deep questions and then they're answering them in sort of this real understanding and sort of texture with language. And do you know do you know the poet Khadijah Queen?
I only know by name.
Yeah, she's
I can't say I know.
She's
work.
Yeah, she's she teaches with a friend of mine in Denver, and her poetry is just, every time I see her in a journal, it's just so playful and yet so very political, spot on, like, you know, don't look at my body. It's really amazing work. And so I just think that's, that's the stuff. I think I started out I'm always coming back to people who are questioning and thinking about, you know, has God abandoned us in some way? Which, you know, feels relevant to the current moment.
It's a question that comes up, yeah.
Yes, yes.
But what's interesting is, of course, it's a question that has come up for centuries.
Yes.
And this is our moment of asking it for a particular set of reasons, or what seems like a particular set of reasons. Nevertheless, it's a classic question.
It's, yeah.
So what are you reading now?
What am I reading?
And it doesn't have to be poetry.
No,
it could be The Oregonian.
I read constantly, and I like to read nonfiction as well as fiction all the time, and poetry. I am reading actually Ruth Ellen Coker's latest book, which the name has now escaped me. But I'm also reading, I just read Siddhartha Mukherjee's The Gene, which was astonishing and terrifying.
And he's pretty good.
He's pretty good.
Yeah.
And then I like to do this. I read all of C.D. Wright's work recently, like all of it in a row.
In chronology.
Yeah. I find that, because it's interesting.
I love doing that.
Yeah. I was not a huge fan of her in the 90s. I think partially because I was with a man who was from Appalachia, and he did not enjoy people writing in dialect. He thought it was dismissive.
Disrespectful.
Yeah. And so interesting, but now to read it now and to read all of, like to see her evolution has been gorgeous. And I did the same thing with, do you know the writer Sarah Manguso?
Well, not enough to say yes, but go
she
on.
Was a poet who I read years ago, and now she writes memoir, but she writes her memoir in like very poetic style, these sort of short little paragraphs, and really beautiful,
like Lydia Davis with
prose. but much more lyric. Sorry, Lydia. I can't criticize Lydia Davis, but still,
but
I'm
still,
criticizing
it's a
her.
Different thing. Well, no, it's just
yeah,
a
it's
description.
A totally different style. Lydia Davis, she wrote that, I remember one of her short stories very distinctly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just her stuff is just right in your body. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Sarah Mongoose is another one. I like to read in sequence, and I've been reading Nathaniel Mackey too. He's the other one. He's impossible. Like you have to, he's like Shakespeare. You have to read him out loud to somebody. Yeah.
I sometimes think that really I should read everything out loud. Right. I'm a walker. I do this when I'm reading pieces, versions of my own stuff.
Yeah.
I walk around my home. I make like a turn around the furniture, and then I do it in the opposite direction, reading out loud.
You're like 90% to memorizing. You're ready to go. You're going to be there. That's how I memorize.
Oh, yeah?
Okay. I move around, yeah.
And then, of course, because it's the 21st century and I actually like this too, I go back to the machine and make changes with the keyboard. Yeah. But the walking and the reading out loud are really important, whether it's my work or somebody else's.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I suppose it's... It's like this, the theater troupe here in Portland that they call themselves Original Practice because they believe that this is the way Shakespeare's company and the other companies of that time operated. But it reminds me of that,
right.
You know. And they only learn their own parts. They don't have to necessarily read the whole play. It's pretty interesting conceptually, if I may use that term in this context. It's pretty interesting to think about what that might have meant 400-something years ago and also right now. I see these people in the parks in the summertime, and I think about this stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think we have used all of my questions. So I'm going to tell everybody that's listening that next month's Poetry and Everything will be on the air on July 24th. And then, of course, as you know, after that, should you not happen to tune in at 10 p.m. on July 24th, you can still find whatever that show is and all the rest of them online anytime you want. And also sign up for the podcast version. So thank you for listening, folks. Remember, this is important. You must remember this, as the song says. Support your local independent bookstores, your independent small press publishers, and independent radio. Thanks, good night.
Thanks so much, Judith.
Inside your shoes. prisoner in KBOO. This is KBOO Portland. This is the Sudden Radio Project.
Shut up, you stupid pooch. Quiet.